Right. So I want you to close your eyes for a second. Just transport yourself to the middle of the North Sea. It's say the mid 1980s. You're standing on the deck of this massive offshore oil rig. The wind is howling, waves are 40 feet high, and the water down below is barely above freezing.
It's an unbelievably hostile environment.
Right.
Probably one of the most unforgiving places on Earth to build anything, let alone a structure that's supposed to house people and, heavy machinery.
Exactly. And the thing keeping you out of that freezing water is this massive structure of steel. Tons and tons of it. But here's the terrifying part when you really stop and think about it. The integrity of that entire structure, whether it holds up against a rogue wave or just catastrophically collapses, it all comes down to the microscopic architecture inside the welded joints holding it all together.
And that is the tension of heavy engineering right there. We tend to think of steel as this monolithic, solid, unchangeable thing. But at the molecular level, especially inside a weld, it is a battlefield.
And that brings us perfectly to the source material for today's deep dive. We are looking at a pivotal conference paper from 1986. It was presented in London. The title is Computer-Aided Design of Electrodes for Manual Metal Arc Welding.
Which, on the surface, I have to admit, sounds incredibly dry.
Oh, it does.
It really sounds like something you'd scroll right past without a second thought.
For sure. But once you peel back the layers, it's actually the story about a massive shift in human technology. It's the moment we move from, let's say, alchemy, just mixing things in a pot and hoping for gold,
Right, the cook and look method.
to architecture, actually calculating the atomic structure of a material before it even exists.
That's a very fair assessment. This paper really captures that transition from empirical trial and error to fundamental predictive science.
So let's set the stage. Why was this paper even necessary? We've been welding metal for a long time, bridges, tanks, ships. Why in 1986 did we suddenly need a computer to design a welding electrode?
Because the specific requirements for the offshore oil industry had, well, they'd hit a wall. They needed steel that was almost contradictory.
Contradictory.
They needed extremely high yield strength. The paper specifically cites a target between 540 and 560 megapascals. That is incredibly strong. But usually in metallurgy, when you make steel stronger, you also make it more brittle. You add carbon or silicon to harden it. But on an oil rig, brittle is a death sentence.
Because of the waves, the
But for
constant motion
the
we're through.
waves, the wind, the cyclic loading, exactly. The metal needs toughness. And in engineering, toughness is not the same as strength. Toughness is the ability to absorb energy without fracturing. If a crack starts, and in that environment, cracks will eventually start, you want the metal to arrest it, to stop it in its tracks, not shatter like a piece of glass.
So they were stuck. They couldn't add the usual things like carbon because that would kill the toughness.
Precisely. The paper notes they had to keep carbon very, very low, around 0.045%, and silicon around 0.3%. Those are incredibly tight constraints.
So what do you do?
To get the strength back up without making it brittle, they had to play with manganese and nickel.
Okay, so just add more manganese and nickel. Problem solved. Why do we need a computer for that?
If only it were that simple. This is where we get into the chaos of manual metal arc welding, or MMA. It is just a messy, violent process.
The paper lists out the variables involved, and it is a laundry list. You've got arc voltage, current, welding speed.
And interpass temperature.
Which is what exactly?
That's the temperature of the metal between the layers. If you're welding a really sick joint on a rig, you can't do it in one pass.
Sure, you do multiple passes.
And if the metal is still scorching hot from the last run, that completely changes how the next layer cools. And then you have dilution.
Which I'm guessing isn't about making a drink weaker.
Ah, no. In welding, it means mixing. You aren't just melting the electrode rod to fill a gap, you're also melting the edges of the heavy steel plates you're joining.
Ah, so they all mix together in the liquid pool.
They do. So the final chemical composition isn't what was in your rod, and it isn't what was in the plate. It's some kind of hybrid.
So, if I can use an analogy here, it's like trying to bake a cake, but the oven temperature is fluctuating randomly. You're throwing ingredients in while it's already baking, and the pan itself is melting into the batter.
That is a disturbing image, but yeah, it's pretty accurate. In the past, the only way to solve this was cook and look.
Make a weld, break it, see if it worked.
Change one variable, do it again. It was slow, it was expensive, and it was incredibly wasteful.
And this is where our 1986 researchers, Svensson, Gritoft, and Podesius, step in. They said, Let's stop guessing. Let's calculate.
They proposed a fundamental approach. They wanted to actually model the microstructure development based on thermodynamics and kinetics.
Okay, before we get into the computer model, we have to talk about how they got the data for the model, because this is my favorite detail in the entire paper.
I think I know what you're going to say.
They didn't just look at the weld from the outside, they used harpooning.
Yes. The experimental validation. To model how the steel crystallizes, you absolutely have to know exactly how fast it cools. You need that cooling curve.
But we're talking about a pool of liquid steel that is thousands of degrees hot. You can't just stick a meat thermometer in there?
No, standard equipment would vaporize instantly. They used platinum and platinum-rhodium thermocouples.
So sensors that can survive the heat.
Right. And to get them into the very center of the weld pool, right behind the electric arc, they literally fired them into the molten metal.
I just love the commitment to the data there. It's like a tiny whaling expedition shooting sensors into liquid metal.
It was necessary. They had to capture the cooling rate specifically between 800 degrees Celsius and 500 degrees Celsius.
Why that specific window? Why 800 down to 500?
That is the critical time. That's the window where the liquid turns solid, and more importantly, where the solid decides how to arrange its atoms.
Ah, that's where the phase transformations happen.
That's it. If you cool through that window in, say, 5 seconds, you get one type of steel. If you take 20 seconds, you get something completely different, even if the chemistry is identical.
And they proved this with their two test electrodes, right? The type A and type B.
Correct. This is a really clever control. Both electrodes deposited metal that was chemically very similar.
Yeah.
But type A had a different coating than type B. And the coating on type A acted like a blanket. It made the weld cool down much, much slower.
So if the computer model works, it should be able to look at the chemistry, look at the cooling speed, and predict two totally different outcomes.
Exactly. It separates the chemistry from the thermal physics.
Okay, so we had the harpoon data. We know how fast the temperature is dropping. Now we feed this into the computer. How does a computer in 1986 see a piece of steel?
It sees it as geometry and energy. The paper describes the first structure to form, it's called austenite, as hexagonal prisms.
Like a honeycomb.
Sort of. Imagine a 3D honeycomb of long six-sided columns, all growing in the direction of the heat flow. That's the primary structure. But that's not the steel we end up with.
Yeah, because it's too hot.
It's unstable. As the temperature drops, that austenite wants to transform into something else, into ferrite.
And this is where the nugget of insight comes in. This isn't just magic or random chance. The computer is actually calculating a race.
Precisely. It is a race between thermodynamics and kinetics. Thermodynamics asks the question, do the atoms want to move? That's the Gibbs free energy part. It calculates the energy incentive for the crystal structure to change.
And kinetics.
Kinetics asks, can the atoms move fast enough? It calculates the diffusion coefficients. For example, how fast can a single carbon atom wiggle its way through the iron lattice to get out of the way?
So as the temperature is plummeting, the computer is calculating, okay, we're at 700 degrees, the carbon wants to move, can it? Yes, okay, grow this crystal. Now we're at 600 degrees, it's getting harder to move. Stop growing that crystal, start growing this one.
That's a great way to visualize it. It's calculating these time-temperature transformation diagrams. It predicts exactly when one type of microstructure stops growing and the next one takes over.
Let's talk about those microstructures, because the paper breaks them down into a kind of cast of characters. And apparently, for our oil rig, there are heroes and villains.
Villain might be a little strong, but certainly some are less desirable than others. The computer divides the steel into four specific categories based on shape and location.
First up, allotriomorphic ferrite.
Right. This is the first one to form. It grows on the grain boundaries, so the edges of those honeycomb hexagons we talked about. It forms these little layers or crusts along the borders.
So it's basically outlining the honeycomb.
Exactly.
Then we get Widman-Stettin ferrite, which is a mouthful.
It is. This one grows as plates that project out from those boundaries into the grain. You can think of them as long needles growing inward from the edges.
Okay, and then the one we actually want, acicular ferrite.
The hero of the story, acicular ferrite is special. Unlike the others, it doesn't grow from the grain boundaries. It nucleates, or, you know, it starts growing inside the grain itself on tiny non-metallic inclusions.
So it's growing from the inside out.
And it grows in all these random directions. It forms a kind of basket weave structure.
Why is that basket weave so much better than the layers or the needles?
Think about a crack trying to move through the metal. If you have long, straight needles or layers, like the Widman-Stettin or the allotriomorphic ferrite, the crack could just follow that straight line. It zips right through. It's like a highway.
But with the basket weave.
The crack has to constantly change direction. It has to zigzag, turn, and twist to get through that chaotic, interlocking structure. That takes energy, it slows the crack down. And that is what we call toughness.
So the computer's entire job is to predict what percentage of the steel will turn into that tough basket weave acicular ferrite versus the more brittle layers.
Correct. And it also has to calculate the microphases, which are basically the leftovers.
Yeah.
The bits of austenite that didn't transform or that turned into hard, brittle martensite.
So the big question, did it work? It's 1986. Did the computer's prediction actually match reality?
This is the man versus machine moment, really. To check the computer's work, they used another piece of high-tech gear for the time, the Quantumat 720 Image Analyzing Computer.
Which is what? It looks at a microscope image of the real weld and counts the pixels of each shape?
Essentially, yes. It traces the boundaries and calculates the actual volume fractions of each type of crystal.
And the results? They weren't perfect at first, were they? I noticed in the source material that for the first type, the latriomorphic ferrite, the computer was off.
No, and this is really important. Science is rarely perfect on the first try. The paper notes that for the latriomorphic ferrite, that crust on the edges, the theoretical calculation was off. The theory predicted about half of what was actually there.
That's a pretty big error, a factor of two.
In engineering, yes. But they didn't scrap the model. They realized that the theory assumes a perfect equilibrium. It assumes atoms behave perfectly.
And welding is not perfect.
It's violent and it's fast. So they applied an empirical correction.
They calibrated the tool.
That's it. They found a linear relationship. They saw the real value was consistently related to the calculated value. So they just added a correction factor to the code.
Yeah.
The real volume equals 2.004 times the calculated volume plus a small constant.
It's like sighting in a rifle scope. If you know it always shoots 2 inches to the left, you just aim 2 inches to the right.
Precisely. And once they applied that correction, the model became incredibly predictive. It correctly showed that electrode A, with its slower cooling, had way more of that allotriomorphic crust than electrode B did.
But the real insight, the thing that really matters for the engineers designing these things, was what they discovered about nickel.
This was the payoff. This is why you build a model in the first place. The simulation revealed a non-linear relationship. It showed that the microstructure is highly sensitive to the nickel concentration, but only when the manganese is low.
Explain that. Why does that combination matter so much?
Remember, we're trying to balance these elements to get that toughness. The model showed that if your manganese is around, say, 0.7%, which is relatively low, adding just a little bit of nickel drastically changes the structure. It shifts the balance away from the tough acicular ferrite and creates more of the brittle phases.
But if the manganese is high,
then adding nickel doesn't really change the structure much at all. It's stable.
That is a huge insight. If you're an engineer designing an electrode, that tells you exactly where your safe zone is.
Exactly. You don't have to melt a ton of steel just to figure out that nickel's going to mess up your weld if your manganese is too low. You don't waste time and resources. The computer tells you before you even start.
The paper mentions they ran simulations varying nickel from 1.8% all the way up to 3.0%.
And they did all of that without ever striking a single arc. That is the efficiency gain. Instead of cook and look, it becomes compute and confirm.
It changes the entire workflow. You don't use the experiments to find the answer anymore.
Right.
You use the experiments to calibrate the model, and then the model finds the answer for you.
Yes. It moves welding from something of an art form, reliant on the gut feeling of the welder or the metallurgist, to a measured science. The paper concludes by saying this method provides clear guidance for optimization. This wasn't just an academic exercise. It was a tool to make safer oil rigs.
It lets them maximize that acicular ferrite, the tough stuff, and minimize the brittle phases, all by just tweaking the numbers in the code.
And considering the stakes, you know, lives on a rig in the North Sea, that level of predictability is priceless.
It really highlights a theme we seem to touch on a lot here. We look at a process like welding sparks flying, molten metal, smoke, heat, and it just looks like utter chaos. It looks uncontrollable.
But it isn't.
No. Deep down, at the atomic level, it's following very strict rules. Thermodynamics doesn't care if it's messy. The atoms still have to follow the laws of diffusion. They still have to pay that energy tax.
And if you can capture those rules in an equation,
yeah,
you can master the material. You can design materials that push the very limits of what's physically possible, because you're not relying on luck anymore. You're relying on calculated kinetics.
It really makes you look at the world differently. I mean, we look at a massive steel structure, a bridge, a skyscraper, an oil rig, and it looks so solid, so permanent. But listening to this, you realize that its strength comes down to these tiny microscopic decisions that happened in a split second 40 years ago.
A race between temperature and time that determined the entire fate of the structure.
And the fact that we were simulating that race on 1986 hardware is just mind-blowing to me.
It really was the precursor to what we now call digital twins. Today, we model entire airplanes before we build a single part. We simulate car crashes before we ever crush a chassis. But it all started with papers like this, proving that you could trust the math even in the most complex, chaotic conditions.
So here's a thought to leave you with. Next time you cross a steel bridge, or look at the frame of your car, or maybe even the chair you're sitting on, don't just see the gray metal.
Try to imagine the hexagons inside.
Exactly. Visualize that honeycomb. Think about that invisible race that happened when that metal was cooling down from a liquid. Think about the acicular ferret weaving itself together to keep you safe. And then ask yourself, does knowing that the steel was designed by a line of code make it feel more artificial? Or maybe more real?
For me, it certainly makes it feel more measured.
That it does. Thanks for diving deep with us today.
A pleasure.